Welcome to another Vox Talk recorded at the CEPR Annual Symposium in Paris. My name is Tim Phillips. The social stigma surrounding menstruation makes it a taboo topic to discuss openly. If that means girls are less likely to go to school when they get their period, or are stressed when they're there, it can damage both their mental health and their studies. In the second of our podcasts to celebrate International Women's Day, we are asking, what can we do to reduce this stigma? Karen McCaw of the Paris School of Economics is part of a team of economists that ran an experiment in schools in Madagascar to try and make some progress on this problem. And I spoke to her about their innovative approach and its results. I first asked her, what do we actually mean when we use the term menstrual stigma?
It's an excellent question, and I think it probably means something different in different contexts, but broadly speaking, it means that whether it is signs of menstruations or talking about menstruations that people consider as not done, or that girls at least, and women for that matter, feel that they have to be careful about other people being aware that they're menstruating at a particular point in time, whether that leads to, you know, bullying, other exclusion in certain parts of the world, even, you know, worse than that. So broadly speaking, it is the social norms that seem to have developed around this particular topic that limits girls' and women's agency, at least during those days of the month.
Is this pervasive? Do we find it everywhere? Is it more prevalent in some places than in others?
So when I present this research, I usually say half of the people in the room know what I'm talking about. And so, yes, I believe it is pervasive, but also in very different forms and shapes in many different contexts.
You, in your research, are looking at the impact on schoolgirls. How does it affect them?
So we're looking at schoolgirls, in particular in rural Madagascar.
Yes.
Both last grades of primary school and then secondary school. This is a very poor environment, very resource constrained. And an environment where talking about menstruation itself is stigmatized. So there's a taboo around even just communication, including within the family. So they don't know what's happening. They don't know how to handle it. They don't know what, for instance, the menstrual cramps or pain, that that's normal, abnormal, etc. But they also will not have the financial or the material means to deal with menstruation. So they typically, at best, use some old cloth and don't have pads or other materials. What that typically will mean is that there will be leaks or there will be smells that then lead to bullying or just uncomfortable situations. And so that causes a lot of stress to these girls. And so what we show in this research is that while the initial prior was that constraints around menstruation will make girls stay at home instead of going to school during certain days of the month, in fact, what we find is that it may, in this particular context, not necessarily cause absences, but it causes a lot of, you know, mental strain. And then that's where we look further.
There has been a lot of research into how to improve performance at schools, the schooling experience for young people. I've not seen research about this before. Has it been neglected by economists?
There was a study, a very well-known study, 15 years ago, more or less in Nepal, around right. menstrual cups, which also analyzed the traditional theory of change that all the NGOs that work in the sphere have, which is that access to menstrual products is important to reduce school absences. They didn't find that in the same way that we don't find it in Madagascar. And I think a lot of the literature concluded, okay, we've learned this. This is not a first order issue and moved on. The academic literature, while the NGO world, people kept on doing these type of interventions. And so when we started working on this, we first realized that this work in Nepal, that is the best well known, a little bit more recent work in Kenya and Bangladesh, academic, but that's kind of it. And so we said, well, this deserves a second look, going in with the initial theory of change that was similar to the previous studies, but then realizing as we were doing the study that the literature had missed an important mechanism through which the constraints around menstruation and menstrual management may affect school performance, which is through this kind of more mental channel and therefore affects learning through that.
Tell me a little bit more about this intervention. Who provided it?
So this is an intervention designed by CARE, the NGO. They had piloted earlier in Madagascar an approach that they then approached J-PAL and our team at PSC to evaluate. It's a package intervention. So they go into schools, they train teachers around hygiene and menstrual hygiene. They build infrastructure. So they rehabilitate or build latrines and water basins to have access to water. They organize a competition between the schools in terms for kind of being the cleanest, the most hygiene school. And then the teachers that are being trained are asked to talk about hygiene a couple of minutes a day. That's the basic package. The innovative part that we were initially very intrigued by and still are intrigued by is that they also, in those schools, try to identify girls that are positive deviants, so girls that are already willing to speak up about something that other girls fear talking about. They then train those girls quite intensively and then coach them also pretty intensively with the idea that these girls then speak to their classmates and to the other girls in the school, or the boys for that matter, to help normalize discussion about menstruation, to help break the stigma, and then to provide information about menstrual management.
So when the education is being done by teachers and those facilities are being provided, how much of a positive impact does this have on the girls' education?
We don't find impact on absences. The quantity of education doesn't change. But we find that the basic package increases learning, improves the quality of education, and the impacts are quite substantial. In fact, the magnitude is of the size of the more successful education-targeted interventions across the world. So the kind of it's the 90th percentile of what we know for successful educational interventions. To give you a number that speaks potentially more in this context, unfortunately, this is a very poor and constrained context, only 50% of girls and boys, for that matter, pass the school grade any given year.
Mm-hmm.
That goes up to 60% with this package of intervention. So that's a massive increase.
Yes, that's huge.
Of course, it's still too low, still only 60%, but so it goes, it changes a lot.
But it is thousands of girls that will pass, whereas previously they would not have expected to. What's going on, Karen? If there's the same amount of education, what's changing?
And so what's changing seems to be very much the atmosphere in school. In fact, qualitatively, what people told us, this is how we started looking into this, is that there is more solidarity. So girls have bigger networks. They have both more friends that are boys and girls. There is more exchanges going on, and they are feeling better at school. And so we measure the heart rate of the girls at Endline and show that the heart rate is lower in the treatment schools, indicating lower levels of anxiety and a better mental well-being. That provides a very plausible channel then for learning. If I feel better, if I'm not as stressed about either my own menstruation or even just more general, the group dynamics. You know, any given day, some girl is going to be menstruating and there's going to be bullying related to that. So we show that that type of bullying goes down, the severe bullying in particular, and so that the atmosphere is better, providing a more amenable place for learning to happen.
Now, tell me more about this fascinating other arm of the study, the young girl leaders. How were they identified and recruited?
This is really to the credit of CARE of having developed a system to make this work. So they go into work with the school teachers and directors to ask initially a list of candidate young girl leaders that have these characteristics of being willing to speak up about other topics. They will make sure that the girls that are not struggling in school, because of course there is a potential trade-off that they're going to be spending time on this other topic. Girls that are relatively good speakers, although again, they will train them on that. And so they have a step of both quantitative and then qualitative interviews that the local NGOs that CARE work with do. So kind of people from the region interviewing the girls to identify the candidates and then have this relatively intensive training and coaching following.
It's unusual because our mental model of role models is people who follow the rules. And we're really targeting people who break with convention here.
That's right. But we're also trying to target a problem that is different than many other problems we've been trying to target. And so that's, I think, the key insight that CARE had. When we're talking about a stigmatized topic, the typical approach of going for the most popular girl in the room may not be the right approach. And instead, we need to find these people that are that what they call positive deviants and what the psychologists call that. In a much larger study, what we would still want to do is in a certain way compare the two approaches, the gossipers, the popular milder girls versus the social deviants. We need a lot of power for that. And so we were not able to do that because in any given school, of course, the number of candidates is limited. And so there's going to be some overlap between those two profiles. Our study does show, if we look at the heterogeneity, that indeed the schools that have more girls that are kind of stronger positive deviants, we see stronger effects there. So that goes in the line of that this being, you know, part of the mechanism. But there is definitely more to be done there.
And what's the theory here that they can do, the teachers and the facilities and the education cannot do?
They're closer to both the perpetrators and the victims in this case, and are probably also, because they're young, more malleable and able to change their minds first and then change other people's minds. What we also see is that in school environments that are more conservative, so where the norms are stronger, where the stigma is stronger, so within our sample, it is more difficult for them to reach those results. And so this, again, is one of the things we want to do looking forward, is saying maybe in certain contexts you need to combine this with adult leaders, so similarly positive deviants on the adult side to reinforce the breaking of the stigma, really, which is what they're trying to do. And then to at least normalize discussions around menstruations so that then from there on everything else can follow. And I think that's the strong qualitative insight that we saw. We need to make this something that we openly discuss and that the girls feel proud to be able to discuss. And that then triggers the rest. And so these girls, because they have this specific role, they have been selected, the coaches show up to support them, they gain status in the schools. They're not teachers, but they're close because they are doing partly what teachers are doing. And so I think that allows them to have this voice and to reach others.
And the quantitative impact of what they can achieve above what you can achieve using the basic program.
First of all, the reduction in stigma happens in both types of school, but is stronger when we have the younger leaders there. So that's consistent with the story that I was saying. At the same time, the impacts on learning per se and on anxiety are not larger. So that suggests that they are doing something slightly different. Now, there is another result in the paper that is an unintended consequence. In the program that doesn't have the younger leaders, we also have a small but significant increase in early pregnancies. That clearly was not the intended purpose. It goes from it's small, but it's there. Mm-hmm. That it's not there when we have the younger leaders. We verified that also. We went back another year later to make sure this is what's the story. And that's a very clear result. And so the way to interpret this, saying, well, once you have schools where people are feeling better, everybody gets along more, there is more parties, etc., and potentially parents who now know that these topics about reproductive health are being discussed in school may themselves have those discussions less, this potentially explains this negative consequence. When you have the young girl leaders, they're able to offset that. And so they are able to provide the necessary information, but possibly also is a more empowering for the girls treatment. I think the way to interpret this is they provide a more balanced set of skills right to the whole community that allows to offset the potential negative consequence.
Karen, this is a terrifically encouraging result, both in the way in which you've achieved it, the innovation in the methodology, and the scale of the difference that you have made. The potential's clearly huge, but how easy is it to realize that potential? Do you think that this would be as effective in other contexts?
So there's two parts to that story. The first one is other contexts in Madagascar.
Right,
and
yes.
At scale, because this was a pilot intervention in 140 schools. So we are in discussions with the Ministry of Education, who, when they saw these results, were very excited, given the large impacts on learning. And so we're trying to work with them to scale the approach to all public secondary schools in Madagascar. The key question there is going to be, well, if this was a pilot in one region, the qualitative evidence suggests that stigma may be even stronger in other regions. And so there, do we need to adapt the approach? Do we need to think through, for instance, the adult leaders, etc.? So that's kind of part of what's on the agenda going forward. In addition to, you know, the usual scaling concerns with implementation fidelity, etc. Then the second question, obviously, is outside of Madagascar. The education environment in Madagascar, because it's such a poor and resource-constrained context, is very particular. And so we don't know whether in other contexts one would have similar results. So we are in very initial discussions to do replication studies, to test the model as close as possible to the model tested in Madagascar, in other African countries, and possibly also in India, where there is very strong stigma around menstruation. to see whether a similar approach would lead to similar results elsewhere.
I look forward to hearing about the next generation of young girl leaders. Karen, for now, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The paper is called Menstrual Stigma, Hygiene and Human Capital: Experimental Evidence from Madagascar. The authors are Karen McCaw, Julieta Vera Rueda, and Duncan Webb.
Next time on Vox Talks Economics, is there a menopause penalty in the workplace?